Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The famed Santa Fe Trail cut through native land, bringing a constant stream of settlers and U.S. soldiers west for most of the 19th century. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the route's beginning. Much of the information available to the public still leaves out any mention of the Santa Fe Trail's legacy. For tribes, the trail meant both displacement and opportunity. We'll get a view of what the trail changed and how it's viewed by history right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. On Friday, a federal judge declined to issue a new order to halt Wisconsin's wolf hunt, but it's still not clear whether the hunt will proceed this fall. Rob Mincer has more.
The state's wolf hunt, scheduled to begin next Saturday, was already on pause due to an injunction from a Dane County judge that has prevented the state from issuing permits. But in a separate case, six Ojibwe tribes asked a federal judge to block the hunt on the grounds that allowing it to proceed would do irreparable harm to the state's wolf population. And that judge decided not to make a ruling unless the state case is overturned on appeal. So far, state officials have declined to say whether they will appeal. In February, Wisconsin hunters killed 218 wolves in just 3 days, well in excess of the state's quota of 119. Gussie Lord is an attorney for Earth Justice. She says the, quote, botched February hunt has made it impossible to know how many wolves are left in Wisconsin.
There's just so many unknowns here that it's certainly our position that it's, it's not time for another hunt in the same year, the first year the species is taken off the endangered species list.
Hunting advocates say a growing wolf population threatens livestock and pets. For National Native News, I'm Rob Mincer.
Tribes are opposing an advanced nuclear reactor proposal at the Hanford site in Washington, Eric Tigadoff reports.
The Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation have sent a letter to the U.S. Department of Energy saying they don't support the company X Energy's small modular reactor proposal. Mason Murphy is Energy and Environmental Science Program Manager for the tribes. He says the Hanford Nuclear Reservation near the Columbia River is partially within tribally ceded territory under the Treaty of 1855.
Because of that, we anticipate that the small modular nuclear reactors may have impacts on all of the following resources, specifically state and federally listed plants and wildlife, big game habitat, historic properties of religious and cultural significance as defined in the National Historic Preservation Act.
X Energy's proposal involves advanced nuclear reactor technology that could produce more than 300 megawatts of power. The Department of Energy awarded the company $80 million in initial funding in 2020. The company says the technology is based on safe, clean, and affordable technology. The Hanford nuclear site was chosen during World War II to produce much of the country's plutonium for 40 years. That also meant a lot of waste, which is a concern for the tribes. Murphy says there's no solution for long-term storage of nuclear waste, some of which has half-lives of 15 million years. He worries what will happen if nuclear projects continue to be built there.
To me, that would indicate that they are likely to continue developing that nuclear mission, and those resources may never become available if that were the case.
Murphy says the Department of Energy has committed itself to pursuing environmental justice and should consider what that means in this situation.
Some of these larger cleanup sites like the Hanford site represent some of the largest environmental injustice sites. And I think that we need to really ensure that that's being taken into consideration when starting to site some of these technologies.
In 2007, the tribe's Board of Trustees adopted a policy that there should be no new nuclear energy production at the Hanford site without government-to-government consultation. Murphy says the Department of Energy has agreed to meet but has yet to set a date. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Google is kicking off Native American Heritage Month with an interactive doodle. The Google Doodle honors the late Zuni Pueblo weaver, potter, and fiber artist Wiwa. The late Wiwa was a revered cultural leader devoting their life to cultural preservation. Monday's Google Doodle celebrates the art of weaving. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian, presenting the annual Native Cinema Showcase. 47 films representing 39 Native nations in 13 countries, available from November 12th to the 18th on demand at americanindian.si.edu.
This reminder to get your COVID-19 vaccination is provided by the Association of American Indian Physicians and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who support this show. Info at aaip.org or cdc.gov/coronavirus.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. In American history, perhaps no other established trade route had more influence than the Santa Fe Trail. The nearly 900-mile link between Missouri and New Mexico could be considered the country's first major interstate highway, bringing loads of settlers to the Southwest and beyond. If your only introduction to the history of the Santa Fe Trail comes from old movies or from many of the modern historical markers along the route, you might think tribes' only connection to the trail were as relentless and violent aggressors to the lives and property of peaceful settlers looking for a better life out west. But the true history ranges from displacement of established civilizations to a period of prosperity for some tribes. This year marks the 200th anniversary of the start of the Santa Fe Trail. This hour, we'll get a better view of what it meant for the many tribes in its path and its continuing legacy. And as always, we want to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us today from Tempe, Arizona is Dr. James Ridingen. He is the lead researcher and author of American Indians and the Santa Fe Trail, retired professor and founding member of the American Indian Studies Program at Arizona State University. He's Pawnee. Welcome back to NAC, James.
Thank you. It's good to be back on air with you.
James, I'd like to begin by asking you, what inspired you to start your research on the Santa Fe Trail?
I began my research on the Santa Fe Trail as I was doing my thesis and dissertation research back in the 1980s. And I wrote about the impact of the trail, some of the impacts on the trail, on the Pawnee people and Pawnee Confederacy. Then around 2009, 2010, I was contacted by the long distance trail program of the National Park Service to do an in-depth study on Indian relationships with the Santa Fe Trail. And that project consisted of three separate components. One was an annotated bibliography, which I did about, I looked at about 1,500 sources and wrote blurbs on each of those as a part of that. And then the second part was a calendar of contact that listed all documented contact that I could come across between various Indian peoples and the Santa Fe Trail. And that was very extensive. And that calendar of contact shows, as your introduction mentioned, that that contact varied. It wasn't all warfare like historians often presented it to be. It's a very complex and nuanced history. And then the third part was to write up the impact of the trail on several different Indian nations. And I did it on my own people, the Pawnee, the Comanches of the Central Plains, and then two Indian nations that had been removed from east of the Mississippi River to the west of the Mississippi River after the trail had already begun to function. And those were the Shawnee and Delaware.
Now, approximately when did the Santa Fe Trail begin?
It began in 1821 when an individual by the name of Becknell traveled from Missouri to New Mexico in hopes of gaining trade relations with New Mexico. At that time, it was a Spanish colony. And then the Mexican Revolt occurred, and Spain had tried to keep the U.S. out. And for good reason, you know, the United States, wherever it went, the citizens would move in, and before you know it, they were trying to take the land, which they often did. So you can understand why Spain tried to keep out the white Americans. But then Mexico had a policy of opening up trade. So that all happened in 1821, about the time Becknell entered New Mexico. And it continued as an important, mostly a commercial trade route. And then, as you mentioned in your introduction, a route for bringing settlers into New Mexico. It began in earnest in 1822 and continued until the Atchison, Topeka and Santa Fe Railroad came through New Mexico, which made travel substantially easier for those who wanted to go back and forth between New Mexico and Missouri, by which time, New Mexico had become a territory of the United States.
Now, there has not been a lot of research on the Santa Fe Trail from a Native American perspective. Why is that, James?
For one reason, we have very few scholars, and there are so many issues to deal with. I think it's existed beyond the scope of a lot of Native scholars. And my research, as I mentioned, has dealt with the Pawnee Confederacy and the Pawnee people by and large. So, you know, the trail became a very important part of that relationship between the Pawnees and the U.S. government and white American citizens. And there was, peaceful trade at times, but there was also some aspects of a very dark history. For example, in the early 1830s, a group of Pawnees had visited a caravan that was traveling along the trail. And when those Pawnees got back to the Pawnee homeland in central Nebraska along the Platte River, a smallpox epidemic broke out. And the Pawnees attributed that smallpox epidemic to gifts given to those individuals that were tainted with the smallpox virus. And that epidemic had a tremendous impact on the Pawnee people. It killed about half of the population and created a lot of hardships, you know, like pandemics do.
So beyond just being a trade route, with goods being exchanged, it was also an avenue for sickness and pandemic, apparently. Now, the trail ran through what is now the state of Missouri into what is now New Mexico. But initially, there were multiple trade routes that connected those territories. Can you talk about those different routes?
Yeah. Indigenous peoples had lived in that area since the beginning of time, according to our traditions. And there was a great deal of contact between the various Indian nations, trade networks that existed throughout the Americas. So it is very likely that there was already a route there that that the indigenous peoples had. Right before the trail started, a group of Pawnees actually led an individual by the name of, I forget his name, but he became one of the first governors, territorial governors of New Mexico and the U.S., and they led him across the southern plains into New Mexico. So that's just an example showing the knowledge that indigenous peoples had of the land and the way to get from one destination to another.
Folks, we're talking today with Dr. James Riding In. We're learning about the Santa Fe Trail, and we really would love to get your comments. Give us a call. 1-800-996-2848. We'll get you on the air. James,
You mentioned earlier that New Mexico was at one time, and during the early years of the Santa Fe Trail, it was under rule of the Spanish crown. And at one point, the Spanish crown made it illegal for trade among Native Americans. How did that impact the trail?
The Spain's influence was, or presence was pretty much gone by the time that the trail started. And then it became a Mexican territory. So Mexico was open to trade with the United States. So Spain was pretty much out of the picture by then. But before then, you know, Spain was like a typical European colonizer trying to control indigenous peoples, lands, resources, and managed to conquer the pueblos of New Mexico and keep them under political and cultural subjugation a number of years, but it didn't have the power to extend its reach into the plains. In 1721, Spain sent a delegation into Pawnee country to try to control the Pawnees, because, you know, Pawnees sometimes raided New Mexico and also engaged in trade relations with New Mexico. So the Pawnees' response to that Villa Sur expedition was to fight and to defeat that party and to send it back to New Mexico. So my interpretation of that is that the Pawnees, through contacts with Pueblos and others, knew about the negative aspects of Spanish colonization, you know, the attempts to force religious conversion, to take lands, and to subject indigenous peoples to coercive policies and involuntary labor.
Folks, if you have a comment for today's show, call in 1-800-996-2848. We're talking about the Santa Fe Trail with Dr. James writing in. You can also email at comments@nativeamericacalling.com. We'll be back right after this break. The Atlanta Braves' appearance in the World Series puts the team's objectionable imagery on a broader stage. The team has a partnership with the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, but criticism continues over the use of the team name and the tomahawk chop. We'll check in on troublesome mascots on the next Native America Calling.
Too many do not have access to affordable high-speed internet. That's why AARP fought for the Emergency Broadband Benefit, a federal program to help lower the cost of high-speed internet for eligible households. Those who may have experienced financial setbacks during the pandemic or are struggling to get by may be eligible for a discount of up to $50 per month for high-speed internet or up to $75 per month for households on tribal lands. Info at aarp.org/EBB. AARP supports this show.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The start of the Santa Fe Trail turns 200 this year. For about 80 years, it was the main route west for countless settlers. Today, we're getting the native view of the Santa Fe Trail that cut across lands occupied by Kiowa, Cheyenne, Pawnee, Arapaho, and other tribes. What do you know about the Santa Fe Trail? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-996-2848 And we're talking with Dr. James writing in. And James, we've spoken earlier about the trade and connecting tribes with European settlers. And I remember as a young child growing up in New Mexico and speaking with my grandmother, and she would explain to me, especially I remember going up to Taos Pueblo one time and noticing that the Taos people had very different styles than our Southern Pueblo people. and they wore their hair differently and they dressed differently. And she explained to me then that Taos at one point was a major trading hub for Pueblo people and Native peoples in that area. And you had a lot of Southern Plains tribes that would come and trade with the Taos. And because of that, some of those cultural styles and appearances, the Taos people adapted. So I'm curious, what are different cultural exchanges that occurred amongst different Native American tribes because of the Santa Fe Trail?
Those relations existed, as you mentioned, before the Santa Fe Trail. Various plain groups had trading relations with the Pueblos. Pecos Pueblo, which the trail went right by, but at a time when the Pecos was in decline, there was a great deal of trade that existed between the Plains Indians and the Pueblos, and at Taos too. Yeah. Taos was a major trade center that brought a lot of people into the area, and even Taos and other Pueblos would go onto the Plains and hunt buffalo periodically. After the Pueblo Revolt, a number of Taos moved onto the Plains for a number of years, and I think that probably helps explain the difference in the dress and the way that the Taos people wore their hair and braids, like a lot of the Plains people did in those years. So, you know, it was a trade that continued even after the Santa Fe Trail. It was, you know, just a part of that history of indigenous peoples come together in both conflict and in peaceful relations.
What were some of the goods that were traded on the Santa Fe Trail?
These were goods that were brought from the United States, and these goods could be, you know, anything like cloth, manufactured goods, just a whole assortment of types of trade goods, and it was a very lucrative business for white America. A lot of money was made, so that's why the trail prospered, and it became such a huge factor in bringing non-Indians through Indian land. Was the prospect of making money. A lot of money was indeed made off of the trail, but then it was also a route to bring settlers into New Mexico as well. And as I mentioned earlier about Spain wanting not to let white Americans into their territory, especially for trading purposes, and Mexico changed that policy to the detriment of its land holdings. So, you know, the Mexican War broke out, and the United States used that as a justification for forcing Mexico to cede half of its territory, which I should mention was still Indian land. Indians never ceded this land. It was claim was established through what's called a doctrine of discovery, this notion that Europeans were culturally inferior and had the superior religion of Christianity. And just the European passing through land or coming to the tip of it or whatever and claiming that land on the behalf of its crown. And so it's a part of this history of Western European expansion, competition between competing foreign nations, and oftentimes indigenous peoples being caught up in those relationships and that history.
Now, you mentioned the Spanish-American War and its influence with the trail. The Civil War also occurred around that same time frame. Was the Santa Fe Trail a factor in the Civil War?
It had to do with expansion, U.S. expansion. Slavery was a big issue, and the country was divided over whether new territory should be free or slave. And so, you know, that came into play, that dialogue you know, compromises were tried to work out to keep the union together, to try to, you know, limit the number or keep balance probably between the number of free and slave states. I think that the major impact of the Civil War would be was that it opened up more travel along the Santa Fe Trail into New Mexico because resources that the country had that could have been used to support expansion were used to support that bloody Civil War, which resulted in the deaths of about 600,000 Americans.
Yes. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was finished with that thought.
James, your research begins with a really compelling narrative about you driving along the current route of where the Santa Fe Trail was. Can you describe that experience and what information was available when you began your research?
I took that trip because I had already begun that project on the Santa Fe Trail. I had gone to Nebraska, you know, our ancestral Pawnee homeland, which, you know, we were removed to Oklahoma in the 1870s. But I wanted to go along that route just to get an idea of the landscape, because a lot of those places along the route had Pawnee place names, like Pawnee Rock, which was a butte that stood several hundred feet tall that had a lot of mythology amongst white Americans attached to it. There was a Pawnee River and other places that had Pawnee names. So I wanted to go through there just to look at it and to see what was left of the trail and to look at some of those historical markers. And Fort Larned was a fort that was important along the trail. And we need to mention that that the U.S., beginning in the late 1820s, the United States military began to play a very vigorous role in the trail's history, trying to protect settlers who Plains Indians viewed as trespassers because no consent was given by them except in two instances. There was treaties with the Kaws and the Osage Indians that addressed the Santa Fe Trail and its traffic. But all the other groups, they didn't have treaties, that authorized the United States to expand into the plains. So, you know, Indians viewed this as trespassing. And the United States military came in to try to protect the settlers and their activities. And their activities were, along with travel, you know, the travel spread disease, led to conflict, also peaceful relations. Livestock and the settlers, or the travelers, polluted water, destroyed trees, plants, and other vegetation that the Indians relied on. They desecrated sacred lands. They looted Indian burials and engaged in other activities that created conflict, that helped lead to conflict and to perpetuate that conflict. So the United States military responded not to protect Indian rights and interests, but to facilitate that trade, to keep it lucrative and to try to protect the these aggressors against Indian reprisals. So there were forts established beginning in the 1840s. In the 1820s, moving patrols were used, and it was mostly by infantry, which, you know, the Plains Indians were mounted, and they had a hard time trying, at least foot soldiers had a hard time trying to fight the Plains Indians because of their mobility. And so a whole string of forts were established.
Now, James, there were some tribes that benefited from the Santa Fe Trail. How did they do that?
The ones that gained the most benefit from the trail were those Indian nations that were removed from east of the Mississippi River to the west of the Mississippi River because of the Indian Removal Program. The Indian Removal Act was passed, I believe it was in 1830. But even before then, the United States had purchased what's called Louisiana Territory, which was still Indian territory. But that's the deed game that the Europeans played amongst themselves and white America, was to trade or sell these land claims of lands belonging to Indian peoples. But anyways, the federal government moved almost 30 Indian nations into Kansas, eastern Kansas. And by then, these groups had been pretty much politically subjugated and had lost the ability to resist U.S. expansion, like the Shawnees who under Tecumseh and others, you know, had tried to stop the expansion of the United States in the early 1800s. So these groups, they had to make some tough choices about how to live. And many of them developed policies of accommodation and even cultural adaptation. So when I came into Kansas, the trail went right through the lands that were attained by the Shawnees and the Delawares and others. And these people began to serve as employees for some of these caravans, guides, hunters, and even U.S. military expeditions that went along the trail. And they also treated their agricultural produce with the travelers on the Santa Fe Trail. So it did bring a degree of prosperity for many of them, not all. But after that territory was established as a U.S. Territory, you know, this eastern Kansas, through the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854, settlers began moving in. Treaties were established to encourage Indians or to force Indians to cede more land. Then after the Civil War, the United States government began to move those peoples from Kansas into Indian Territory or Oklahoma. And today there's four indigenous groups left in Kansas, and they were removed there through the U.S. policies of removal.
Now, you mentioned that the U.S. established the Santa Fe Trail for the use of settlers heading west. They then authorized federal troops to protect those settlers. Did the U.S. government anticipate that settlers wouldn't be welcomed by these tribes?
Early, it was mostly traders who were using the trade route to go over the trail. And, you know, by this time, that notion of manifest destiny was alive and well, even though that term manifest destiny wasn't coined until the 1840s by a guy named John O'Sullivan. But the concept of manifest destiny was ongoing, and it meant that white Americans had a God-given right to expand across the continent and to take the land and resources belonging to others. So it was a part of that mentality of expansionism, this mindset that the country was going to expand, and the Santa Fe Trail was definitely a part of that history of manifest destiny.
Settlers, obviously many of them stopped in New Mexico, made homes in New Mexico. What other areas of the West were settlers traveling to via the Santa Fe Trail?
The Santa Fe Trail went on through Santa Fe into California. It went south into Mexico. So, it became an important route that took exploratory expeditions into California. The Army of the West used the Santa Fe Trail as it moved into New Mexico during the Mexican War in the 1840s. So it served as an important route for the expansionistic endeavors of the United States, to the detriment of indigenous peoples.
Now, you mentioned earlier how you had driven that route where the Santa Fe Trail once was. And I've driven that route a number of times myself through the Midwest into New Mexico. And I think of Interstate 40 that runs through parts of Oklahoma, the Texas Panhandle. How closely does modern day Interstate 40 align with what was once the Santa Fe Trail?
Yeah, having been raised in New Mexico a number of years when I was young, and lived in New Mexico and now Arizona for all these years, I've traveled I-40 many times. But the trail was basically north of I-40. The trail went from a general area of Kansas City, Missouri, in a southwestern direction through the Oklahoma Panhandle, then through Las Vegas by Pecos Pueblo, and then up to Santa Fe. Then there was the mountain, what's called the mountain route, that right about the Oklahoma Panhandle. It went into Colorado, and then south from there through Raton Pass down to by where Fort Union was established in the 1850s, and it joined up with the other Santa Fe Trail.
This is Native America Calling. We would love to hear from you today. Call in at 1-800-996-2848. We're having a wonderful discussion today with Dr. James writing in. You can also reach out on Facebook at Native America Calling or on Twitter at 1-800-99-NATIVE. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Life's an adventure, but your health shouldn't be. Check out open enrollment option November 1 through January 15. Contact your local Indian healthcare provider for more information. Visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. Message from Center for Medicare Medicaid Service.
Thanks for tuning in today. This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We're learning about one of the most influential routes in American history, the Santa Fe Trail. It was a means for displacement of many tribes from Missouri to New Mexico. It was also a source of commerce and cultural interaction for other tribes. Join our conversation today. The number is 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we have a caller on the line, Tom. He's in Wounded Knee, South Dakota. He's listening on Keeley. Tom, you're on the air.
I like to say, how are you doing, my beautiful sacred people out there? My comment on this Santa Fe Trail, it leads me to talk about what the man was talking about, the doctrine of discovery. That is, itself is it's a deceiving, just like here in Lakota land. The doctrine of discovery is a dimensional, two-dimensional doctrine. Now, in our ways, Lakota, when you speak Lakota, that's sacred, and it's all around. It's like water. It's all around us, and it's not deceiving. Where we learn it through ears and many, many, many generations of through the tongue. That language itself keeps our people alive. Where the doctrine of discovery, it's a two-dimensional doctrine, where it's deceiving, just like our language today in the school systems. They teach them with a two-dimensional method. Okay, here's a piece of paper. You say, how are you? Doshke yauho. And they write it down. Well, long ago, our ancestors didn't do that. We learned it through ears. We learned it through our tongue. And I have a grandfather. We have a grandfather that always told us about that doctrine of discovery. Always remember, that's just an invading piece of paper that they threw at us. But with our tongue, with our language, that's what keeps us alive. And I believe that. But with this pandemic going on, my mother, she's an elder. She's always saying, pray every morning and every night. So I do. I pray for my people. That's who I pray for first. But the Santa Fe Trail itself is just the same thing what we went through. And, you know, all the goods and stuff can be thrown in there. But that's their ways.
Tom, thank you for those comments. And I'd like to ask James, Tom just mentioned the doctrine of discovery. How does that play into the creation, or how did it play into the creation of the Santa Fe Trail, James?
Well, it's just part of a broader mentality that Europeans and their progeny, white Americans, had superior rights to indigenous peoples. And we have to keep in mind that the mindset cast Indians as warlike, vicious, inferior subhumans. And that was just a justification, I think, maybe to soothe the consciousness or give the facade of legitimacy to a ruthless territorial expansion and the access of lands and resources, and to gain access to lands and resources belong to other peoples. And it's still a part of U.S. law today. The Supreme Court has cited the doctrine of discovery in recent years to help deny Indian land claims. So it's still with us. It's a foundation of federal Indian policy. So what the doctrine does, it says that Indians do not have ownership rights of the land. With discovery, the land passed from the hands of indigenous peoples to the discovery European nation, which is this creation, this legal creation, to promote colonial expansionism. And that mentality is still with us today, I think, in many respects. Some of the racial attitudes of white America have diminished, and, you know, Indians enjoy many positive relationships with non-Indians, but there's also a segment of the population who have that old mindset, I believe. And I think we're seeing that today in some of the political protests going on. You know, there's opposition to the removal of these Southern heroes during the Civil War, like Lee, Robert E. Lee, and others. Take down statues and the Confederate flag. Well, you know, those are symbols of oppression and even genocide. And so we have those same symbols with the Santa Fe Trail, and also the way that historians have sought to tell the story that makes white America feel comfortable about this history. And this history denies, you know, us knowledge about this history, the factual aspects of it. And I appreciate that the Lakota brother and what he said, you know, because the doctrine of discovery is still with us.
Absolutely. So you mentioned Confederate monuments, and let's bring this into the present. So, for example, if somebody were to be driving along roads where the Santa Fe Trail once existed, and there's a lot of roadside markers, right? There are monuments in related to the Santa Fe Trail. If somebody were to stop and look at one of those roadside markers today, what are they likely to learn about the Santa Fe Trail?
Just to get a little blurb of factual history. And let me go back to the question that you asked earlier about my trip through Kansas and my trip to Fort Larned. I didn't really develop that then. When I was at Fort Larned, I spoke to one of the guides there who give presentations, and I raised the question about related to what was on a marker that said that 300 Kiowas had attacked that fort. And I asked that individual, do you have any information about why the Kiowas might have attacked that fort? And he started talking in coded terms about Indian savagery. And so, you know, I called him out on that, but then, you know, he was an older male who probably had no desire to learn the actual history and just wanted to promote that false history that existed and share his biased views with visitors to that fort. So it's no wonder that there's so many misunderstandings about the fort with that type of mentality. Yeah, so those roadside markers are very problematic. I've noticed that the museums, there's a couple of museums along the way, and some of them will briefly acknowledge that Indians were trying to defend their lands. But, you know, there's also a defense of sovereignty that went into this, defense of human rights that went into this in terms of Indian resistance to the trail. So, you know, that whole history needs to be reconceptualized. And when it comes down to it, there's only one set of facts, and it's how those facts are interpreted. And historians have tended to interpret those facts in ways that continue to denigrate Indians and to promote this notion of white American supremacy with the means justifying the ends, that Indians had to be subjected and placed on reservations, subjected to coercive assimilation programs for the benefit of the growth of the nation.
Let's talk a little bit more in detail about your research, James. And I know it's carried out by the National Park Service. And we have an interesting comment on Twitter from Bill in Albuquerque, who wants to know if there is a way to include a more balanced account of history that includes what actually went on along the Santa Fe Trail. James, can you comment on that for our Twitter audience?
Yes, these markers, the problematic ones, need to be done away with, and a better interpretation needs to be put in their place. But it's, you know, difficult to do because these roadside markers are not designed to provide a lot of information, and I don't know how many people stop at historical markers besides me and a few others. You know, when I drive through these places, you know, you don't see too many people looking at historical markers.
There's
but
so
you know,
many
it has to
travel
be...
centers. There's so many travel centers along the road that it's just sometimes it's you just want to stop off and grab something to drink. I'm sorry, James. Go ahead. I just had to add that.
Yeah, but it has to be done in a more comprehensive method about finding means to incorporate a more inclusive aspect of this history, to do away with the racism that has permeated much of that historical discourse, and then to incorporate indigenous views into it in a meaningful way, not just a very superficial way. And I think that has been the case, that this superficial acknowledgement of Indian rights. So, I'll be giving a talk on the 13th, I believe it is, in Santa Fe on Indians and the Santa Fe Trail. And this is a part of the commemoration of the 200-year founding of the Santa Fe Trail. And, you know, for many of us, you know, we cannot commemorate colonialism. We cannot commemorate these policies and practices that were genocidal to our to our people. And it led to our placement on reservations in Oklahoma. And because, you know, when the trail started, there were a number of Indian nations along the trail. But by the by the late 1860s, early 1870s, there were no Indians on the trail because they had all been placed on reservations and subjected to a coercive assimilation programs.
James, your research dates back over a dozen years, back to 2008, 2009. Do you think it's had an impact in terms of how officials present this history today?
It's hard to tell. I had a piece published in what's called the Field Journal. It's from the Symphony in Flint Hills in Kansas, And they did a special issue on the Santa Fe Trail. And they have part of my work in that. You know, at least my view and the views of others has been incorporated into this journal. But I don't know how widespread it's been. I need to go back and look at some of the studies that have been done since I did the study, you know, kind of update it. And I plan to do that as I get the opportunity to do so. But, you know, changing the way that the history is written is difficult. It's an ongoing struggle. And we need younger scholars to step up and carry on, you know, this effort to make history more accurate and, you know, more inclusive of the people who are involved in it in meaningful and less biased ways.
James, for better or worse, I, like so many Americans, go to Wikipedia for a lot of my educational and historical information. And I did wiki the Santa Fe Trail, and it only mentions specific tribes in terms of how they violently resisted people who they considered trespassers. Do you know of anybody who expressed interest in editing that page to add more context to the Santa Fe Trail from a Native perspective?
No, I don't. I was asked to do this program, I was asked if there's any other scholars who I could recommend share this program with, you know, or the presentation. And I couldn't think of any, because it's just such an important part of history, but one that hasn't really attracted Native scholarly attention to the degree that it should have.
So you mentioned earlier, James, that the Santa Fe Trail began in 1821. When and why did the Santa Fe Trail cease to be used by travelers?
It continued to be an important travel route until 1880, when the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad was constructed, linked eastern states with New Mexico Territory. And it used to take several months for those caravans to make the trip, but with the railroad, the travel was much faster.
So the railroad is ultimately what ended the Santa Fe Trail as it was known throughout the 1800s as this major thoroughfare for travelers, for traders, for settlers, for Native American peoples as well. That's all the time we have for today's show. I want to thank my guest, Dr. James Ridingen, and also thank him for his scholarship on this very important historical issue affecting Native Americans of many, many different tribal backgrounds and communities, the Santa Fe Trail. Join us tomorrow for a discussion about Major League Baseball and the World Series between Atlanta and Houston. The signature sporting event puts imagery on display that Native Americans have complained about for years. We'll also take your calls. This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce.
Inyunakput na kuro. Arlan timikun pira nyalu. Inrola kaminak to si. November 1, January 15th, nga taktilu. Kukula lui, Indian healthcare provided ko yan. Kaisa kangwasi, tulaminasi, healthcare.gov, nakaakilalu, 1-800-318-2596. Una kailuni, Center for Medicare, Medicaid Service kunin.
Support by Roswell Park, who know tribal communities face persistent challenges in health equity, such as cancer and higher death rates. The Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center is dedicated to advancing cancer research that will lead to translatable science, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous populations worldwide. Are you at high risk for cancer? A no-charge online assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.